We would like to extend a sincere apology for the unprofessional conduct of Scott Bam Bam Bigelow yesterday at the Royal Rumble to Lawrence Taylor.
You put yours on. No pants, no helmets, no teammates, Lawrence Taylor. Just me and you. Man on man.
Wait just a minute.
My prediction is true. They're saying that Shawn Michaels has won the Royal Rumble.
I think I'm cute. I know I'm sexy. I've got the look. The drive to go wild. I've got the mood. I said cheer up and down their spine. I'm just a sexy boy. I'm not.
Hello, my name is Bob Bamber and welcome to the Wrestling 20 Years Ago podcast. We're going back in the time machine to January of 1995. Happy New Year, everybody. We are here in Volume 1, reviewing the WWF and specifically the Royal Rumble. Volume 2, we'll be covering ECW as well as the WCW Clash of the Champions. I'm being joined by Chris White. Chris, how are you?
All good. How are you?
I'm doing well. We are being joined by Del Mio, but he's, well, I told him 7:30 and he's not here. So we're going to start the news bit without him and then we'll drop him when we get to some actual discussion. So we start the news that Shawn Michaels has won the 1995 Royal Rumble, beginning from number one and going the distance with the British Bulldog in a match that will switch to 60-second entries. Bulldog had appeared to have won the match, dumping Michaels over the top rope opposite the hard camera, but Michaels clinged on as Bulldog's music played before sneaking up behind Davey Boy and eliminating him. Michaels will face Diesel at WrestleMania as his match with Bret Hart was declared a draw following interference.
Another big story coming out of the Rumble was the confrontation at ringside between Bam Bam Bigelow and former New York Giants linebacker Lawrence Taylor. The pair squared off before Bam Bam shoved him to the ground in what was an angle that had many people believing it was real. The follow-on Raw, which we hear of later in the show, involved Bam Bam to apologise before challenging Taylor to a match.
Lex Luger's contract with the WWF expired this month, but it would appear that he's not going anywhere for now. There were rumours that he could be returning to WCW as he co-owns a gym in Atlanta with Sting, but it's said that Luger and Eric Bischoff are not on the best of terms. For what it's worth, Luger was one of the final four in the Royal Rumble match alongside Michaels, Bulldog and the returning Crush.
The WWF celebrated the second anniversary of Monday Night Raw on January the 9th with a busy show. The major match was an excellent TV match between Owen Hart and Razor Ramon, with Razor retaining his Intercontinental title. We also saw an appearance from William Shatner, who was on the show to promote Tech War, a program debuting on the USA Network after Raw. In the main event, Howard Finkel fought Harvey Whippleman in a tuxedo match, which was far worse than it sounds.
There are a number of title changes in the WWF this month. Firstly, Jeff Jarrett defeated Razor Ramon at the Royal Rumble in a match that was restarted after Razor was counted out, Jarrett winning the Intercontinental title. The 1-2-3 Kid and Bob Spark Pug Holly won the tag titles at the Rumble, defeating Tatanka and Bam Bam Bigelow. But on the following night, the Kid and Holly lost the tag titles to the Smoking Guns. There's a scary situation in the rematch on Raw the following week, where the Kid appearing to do himself some serious damage in attempting a senton from the top rope. Fortunately, he was okay following the match.
Jean-Paul Levesque is WWF bound, having handed in his notice with WCW this month. Levesque had offers from both companies, but he said he chose the WWF because of the track record of creating new stars and the upward mobility within both companies. It's said that it could be months before Levesque debuts with the WWF, with a non-complete clause in his WCW contract.
Vince McMahon made a number of comments in an interview with the Howard Scripps News Service. McMahon called the departure of Randy Savage personal and said that it was perhaps hurt him more than Hulk Hogan leaving. He said that Hogan promised he would never compete against him, but the WCW weren't competing very well anyway, describing them as, quote, getting their butt kicked every single day. We'll have a full recap of the interview later in the show.
Jeff Jarrett could be in the WWF title picture sooner rather than later, after he replaced Bob Backlund at house shows after those matches with Diesel weren't going down too well. Jarrett followed up his Intercontinental title win by proclaiming on Raw that he was coming after Diesel.
Because I got something I want to say. Some people mistake a short memory with a clear conscience. Diesel, 7 feet tall. I know what you're all about because I fought you before. This Sunday, you and I are going to find out what it's all about. Now, you talk about backing up and driving over top of me like a big Diesel. Well, you know what, Diesel? I'm waiting for that moment because I've seen you and I know what you can do. Diesel, remember one thing. There has never, ever been anybody in the history of the World Wrestling Federation that can wrestle like I can. I am the excellence of execution. And when people talk about whether or not I've changed, the fact of the matter is, I have changed. I've thought about it a lot, and you know what, Diesel? There's going to be one change in the Royal Rumble, and that change is going to be the World Wrestling Federation Championship belt, because I am not going to be so easygoing. It's no more Mr. Nice Guy. Diesel, I want that belt back.
We start on the 2nd of January on Monday Night Raw with a tag team match between Lex Luger, the British Bulldog, versus Tatanka and Bam Bam Bigelow of the Million Dollar Stable. The heels attack Luger as he gets in the ring, claiming the early advantage before British Bulldog has even appeared. Shawn Michaels, who is on commentary, says that Lex Luger's New Year's resolution is to not be quite so stupid. The match spilled to the outside and all four men got counted out. At the Royal Rumble, we're going to see Razor Ramon versus Jeff Jarrett for the Intercontinental title. The Undertaker will take on IRS, and they are talking up involvement in the match with the Druids. They're promoting the Royal Rumble as the world's largest beach party emanating out of Tampa, Florida. Nobody seems to have told WWF that it might even get cold in Tampa in January. Owen Hart is on the King's Court. He's still giddy with excitement that Brett lost the title because of him at Survivor Series. Owen says he plans on winning the WWF title, and unlike his brother, he's never going to lose it, he's never going to quit, and he's going to retire with the championship. After winning a squash match, Jeff Jarrett and his lackey, now called The Roadie, are out promising his singing debut. But after some technical issues involving the spotlight, Jeff storms off unhappy. Gorilla Monsoon speculates that Razor Ramon may have caused it. They decide to restart the tag match from the start of the show, and Bulldog whips Tatanka into Bam Bam Bigelow on the apron, and it seems like Tatanka knocked himself out, allowing British Bulldog to pick up the victory. Ted DiBiase at ringside is not very happy. We move to WWF Superstars from January 7th. The show was noteworthy for an edition of the Heartbreak Hotel, with numerous superstars claiming they would win the Royal Rumble, including King Kong Bundy, Michaels himself, Bob Backlund, and the British Bulldog. We saw the debut of Mantar, a Minotaur-like character who comes to the ring in full costume. On January 9th, the second anniversary of Monday Night Raw, we start with an Intercontinental Championship match between Razor Ramon and Owen Hart. Before the match, Owen starts by grabs the title off of the referee and hoists it above his head. Razor clotheslines him for that. This was an excellent match that ended when the returning Bret Hart came out to a huge ovation and attacked Owen. Jeff Jarrett and the Roadie ran out as a brawl broke out. An excellent start to the second anniversary of the show. Hakushi debuted and defeated a jobber named Matt Hardy. Next up on Raw is who else but William Shatner on the King's Court. Shatner is on the show to promote Tech War, the show debuting on USA Network right after Raw. Shatner says chewing gum was more impressive than facing Lawler and Raw. Lawler plokes Shatner. Shatner stands up to him. Lawler threatens to punch him, but Shatner nearly puts a hammerlock on him and shoves him into the ropes. Lawler runs at Shatner, who flips him to the outside. This brings out Bret Hart, who comes to celebrate with William Shatner, and Jeff Jarrett and the Roadie come out to hold Lawler back. On WWF Superstars, they are running a tournament to crown the next tag team champions. After the quarterfinals match, we are now left with Bam Bam Bigelow and Tatanka versus the Head Shrinkers, and the Heavenly Bodies versus Bob Holly and the 1-2-3 Kid. A vignette aired for Karma, a new boxer and mixed martial artist inspired by a fighter from the Ultimate Fighting Championship. Karma will be played by Charles Wright, who you may remember as Papa Shango. In the main event, Howard Finkel faced off against Harvey Whippleman in a tuxedo match. The match is about five times as bad as you imagine it being. Both men are wearing red underpants with Raw written on the back of them. Finkel won, despite the fact he probably should have lost. It was terrible. At least it was short. On the 14th January edition of WWE Superstars, Diesel cut an in-ring promo. He was asked if he had changed and said that deep down he was still the same Big Daddy Cool as before. He then moved on to Bret and said that after what happened at Survivor Series, he thinks it would change any man. He said he hoped that the demon seed in Owen Hart hadn't manifested itself in Bret. Diesel says that Bret wrote the book on breaking rules, and the rumour has it Bret will come after his WWF title at any cost. WWF Superstars also hosted the semi-finals of the WWF Tag Team Championship Tournament, with Bam Bam Bigelow and Tatanka defeating the Head Shrinkers, and the team of the 1-2-3 Kid and Bob Sparkplug Holly defeating the Heavenly Bodies. The teams will face off in the final at the Royal Rumble. Monday Night Raw on January 16th, and William Shatner is still with us, this time in the corner of Bret Hart when he faces Jeff Jarrett in the main event. Vince McMahon asks whether there's any ring rust ahead of the Royal Rumble. Bret says there isn't. Incidentally, the Wrestling Observer are saying that the reaction to Shatner backstage was negative, feeling he was stuck up. Earlier in the show, we get a rerun of the Heavenly Bodies vs 1-2-3 Kid and Bob Holly match. Tatanka and Bam Bam and Ted DiBiase arrived on the aisleway to observe the match. The Kid and Holly win. Mantar's gimmick has already changed between shows. His head is now completely shaved with the black face paint streaking back from his eyes. He's now wearing a brown velvet singlet and being managed by Jim Cornette. It's not much of an improvement. In the Hart-Jarrett match, a very good TV standard match which Bret won after a roll through. After the match, William Shatner stormed the ring and knocked the roadie over. Roadie went to the top rope, but his attempt at splash was foiled by Shatner moving out of the way. Shatner then threw the roadie over the top rope. Ted DiBiase cuts a promo on King's Court, surrounded by his million-dollar stable and two druids. He says that his King Kong Bundy is the favourite for the Rumble. Mabel, after winning a squash, lays claim to winning the Rumble on the basis of being the biggest and the baddest. Then King Kong Bundy comes out and questions it. The 21st of January is the final Superstars before the Royal Rumble. Razor Ramon wins a squash match. Then Jeff Jarrett comes out on the video wall after the match and tells Ramon that he wants a match right there and then. Razor goes to accept the challenge, but his microphone cuts dead. After the break, they show footage of the production area and the roadie cutting Razor's mic. Henry Godwin is out with his hog farmer gimmick. He walks out with a bucket of pig shit and places it on the ring steps before winning a squash match. Bam Bam Bigelow and Diesel have replaced Randy Savage in the WWF Slim Jim adverts. Jacob and Eni Blue will debut at Royal Rumble. You will remember these two from 1994, who were the Bruise Brothers in ECW, and even lost a squash match on WCW TV against Hulk Hogan and Sting. Shawn Michaels hosts Bret Hart on the Heartbreak Hotel. Shawn questions whether Bret has had his mind on too many other things, having been away filming for the last couple of months. Bret says that there isn't anyone in the WWF that can wrestle like he can, and he says he has changed and that he's not going to be Mr. Nice Guy if it means getting his belt back.
Now that we have qualified for that final race, Bam Bam, Tatanka, we will see at the Royal Rumble who will get that checkered flag.
You know, we know you guys are tough, but I've been a tag team champion before. No one thought I could do it then, and no one thinks we can do it now. But we're going to show you at the Royal Rumble that we will do it.
And thank you to Colin for that. We're now being joined by Del. Del, good evening.
Hi, Bob.
We will start by talking about, well, the Raw on January the 9th before the Royal Rumble, specifically the second anniversary. Noteworthy for quite a few things, Chris, but I'd say, first of all, an excellent television match between Razor Ramon and the Owen Hart.
Yeah, it was a really great match. It was as, basically as good as you'd ever going to get a match to open Monday Night Raw. Yeah, really, really good solid match, and then good storytelling with the return of Bret Hart later on as well.
Yeah, totally agree with Chris, Bob. Just nice to get these guys getting a bit of time. It's kind of a rematch of sorts of the final for King of the Ring last year for the kind of fell a bit foul to the booking in the night and kind of having a couple of matches and then the time restrictions and just getting them in the ring, giving them enough time to do what we know they can both do was good. See the Bret stuff coming back kind of led into a story going on in the month, and I just love the two performers. I think they work brilliant themselves and they work even better together.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I mean, the pop for Bret on his first TV appearance at Survivor Series was big. These are two guys that can both work. They've both been pushed pretty well over the last year or so. And I kind of hope we see these guys in some bigger pay-per-view match. I mean, I don't know what they've got planned for either man at WrestleMania yet. We'll come to Owen's potential later on, I guess, in that they might still be angling for him and Bret again, although I don't know whether that'll be a good move. Del, is the Owen-Bret thing as good as it was? Has that kind of jumped the shark a bit?
I think it's still got a level of potential, Bob, but just because of the sheer volume of the feud that we've had in the last pretty much about 18 months, I think it's definitely one for the future, I would say. Give the both of them a chance to kind of evolve a wee bit, and it's maybe something that you could come back to in maybe later on in the year or even into 96, I think.
Chris, I mean, is it about time that we see Owen in a feud that isn't with Bret?
Yeah, you'd imagine so. I mean, matches like this go to show just how much potential there is for him working with other guys. So it's an exciting prospect, but I'm still enjoying the stuff with him and Bret.
I think it will. I think it will always be good. It's just whether, you know, law of diminishing returns in terms of there's only so much people are going to buy into that match. We've even had Owen and Bret on Action Zone, I think, when that launched, and they've done it on TV as well. So I think it's, you know, we'll come to the development in that ongoing feud when we get to the Royal Rumble itself. Chris, we move on to later in that show and the appearance of William Shatner. Shatner was on the show to promote Tech War, which is appearing following on from Raw on the USA Network afterwards. Apparently, Shatner was described by some people backstage as being stuck up. But from a TV perspective, Chris, what did you think of his appearance?
It was okay. Jerry the King, obviously, I thought came out looking a lot better than Shatner did. Shatner did a job, but it wasn't excellent by any stretch. Jerry was pretty funny and played his role really well, but that's what you'd come to expect. But yeah, it was okay. I mean, it served a purpose, basically.
Del.
I think Chris summed it up pretty well there, Bobby. Just done a job. He was there to promote his TV show. He kind of got on the back of the legs of the audience that WWF's got with that time slot, and then Tech War's just on after it. It does kind of just strike a bit of a promotional idea. I mean, there was even times kind of just looking at Shatner. You could just tell he was a bit disinterested. But as Chris says, Bob was the... Bob? You weren't on Raw, Bob.
Jerry was the...
You're pulling a bit of weight if you're the King, but I don't think I'd fancy seeing you in that leotard.
No.
King was just his usual self, just an old pro. I mean, if you get anybody in there that's maybe a bit unfamiliar with the wacky world of wrestling, then you can't really put him in any better, safer hands than Jerry Lawler.
So, Del, we go from the great in Owen Hart and Razor Ramon to the okay in Jerry Lawler and William Shatner. And then we get this main event, the main event of the second anniversary of Raw. Think of all the great matches we've had on Raw in the last 2 years. The closing match on Raw, Harvey Whippleman and Howard Finkel in a tuxedo match.
I don't think you can really sum it up any better than the good, the bad and the ugly, Bob. For what it's worth, I mean, I don't know whether it's just the same as what I was like at Survivor Series with Jerry Lawler and his knights and Doink and the Three Clowns. I mean, I thought it was a bit of good fun. The only kind of unsettling bit of it for me was just the prolonged angle at the end on the camera with Fink just walking about in his pants with the bushwhackers got a bit savoury for me that wasn't in my taste, but it was a bit of fun. You would have thought in an anniversary show they could maybe have done something a bit better, but fair play to them. They got their 5 minutes. At least it's done with, hopefully.
Chris,
I'd be slightly harsher. I didn't really enjoy it at all. Not from a, not even in a comedy kind of way. It did nothing for me. And it is really disappointing, as you say, to have it. That is the closing match on the second anniversary of Raw. It's pretty underwhelming, all in all.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I suppose in a sense it's not like, you know, the main event on Raw is traditionally the opening match, so it's not like this was ghastly again. Yeah, most of the time Raw just ends in a squash match, so it's not, you know, it's not that bad, but yeah, this wasn't funny. That they just missed the mark with it, and I don't know why they revisited this angle. They did the angle last month with Six Man with Finkel as part of the Bushwhackers. That was quite good. You know, Finkel looks to be having good fun, but this wasn't anything I would have put in this spot.
Some people say that after that fateful night, you changed. And I'd like to ask you, have you changed? Are you a changed man?
Have I changed?
It's like the same clothes to me.
Now, I might smile a little bit more than I used to. Yeah. But then again, since I won the World Wrestling Federation title, hey, I got a lot to smile about. Okay. Some people say I talk more than I used to.
Yeah, pass the bread. Here comes the baloney.
Since I got rid of Motor Mouth Shawn Michaels.
What? He'll pay for that.
That's a luxury now I can't afford.
Unfortunately.
But have I changed? No, I haven't changed. I'm the same fierce competitor I've ever been. I know only one thing and one way to go. That's straight ahead, pedal to the metal, run over people. Hey, that's Big Daddy Cool. Talk about change. Maybe we should look at my opponent, Bret Hart.
Let's not.
Let's look at Survivor Series.
Is that Bret Hart?
I mean, his brother Owen comes down, manipulates his parents into throwing in the towel and costing Bret the World Wrestling Federation title.
Give that guy credit. Smart move.
I think that's more than any man can take. I think that would change any man. And I hope that the demon seed in Owen Hart hasn't somehow manifested itself in Bret. Let's talk about change. Now, I've seen Bret. He now sports a Grizzly Adams beard. So definitely his outward appearance has changed. But change sometimes can be good, sometimes can be bad. You know, when I was a little guy, about 6'3", I used to watch the World Wrestling Federation.
Nice teeth.
I used to watch Bret the Hitman Hart. I watched him when he tagged with Jim the Anvil Neihardt. Hey, Bret was no choir boy. Bret wrote the book on breaking rules. Rumor has it, Bret's going to come after this belt at any cost.
And we move on to the 1995 Royal Rumble. Dell, start us off with the results.
Yep, starting off with the Intercontinental title match, Bob. It was Jeff Jarrett against Razor Ramon. The match gets stopped midway through due to a count out for Razor. But after the restart, Jeff Jarrett got the belt and is now the new champion. The Undertaker beat Erwin R. Scheister, and in the WWF title match, Diesel and Bret Hart fought to a draw. It was thrown out after multiple interference, and the referee called it a draw between both competitors. Tag title match, the final of the tag team tournament that's been taking place over the last couple of weeks, and it was Sparkplug, Bob Pauly, and the 1-2-3 Kid, who got the better of the Tonka and Bam Bam Bigelow. And in the main event, the Royal Rumble was won by Shawn Michaels. He last eliminated Davey Boy Smith. Both of those guys in it, entries 1 and 2, and lasted the full full match, and the entrance in the Royal Rumble, Sean and Davey Boy, and then Eli Blue, Duke Drossi, Jimmy Del Rey, Head Shrinker Sione, Dr. Tom Pritchard, Doink, Quang, Rick Martel, Owen Hart, Timothy Well, Luke Williams, Jacob Blue, King Kong Bundy, Moe and Mabel from Men on a Mission, Butch Miller, Lex Luger, Mantor, Portuguese Man of War, Aldo Montoya, Henry Godwin, Bart and Billy, the Smoking Guns, Bob Backlund, Stephen Dunn, Dick Murdoch, Adam Bomb, Head Shrinker Fatu, and the last entrant at number 30, a returning crush, and as I say, Shawn Michaels won that. Entrant first, last eliminating Davey Boy Smith.
Well said, Dal. I think next time, even if you're not on the Rumble show, I'm going to make you read out the 30 entrants just because I know you love it so much.
Just give me a roster and I'll be so happy, Bob. It'll be better than Christmas. Just get me reading out a list of names.
There we go. Chris, what do you think of this show?
It was okay overall. It was pretty solid. There wasn't necessarily a lot wrong with it, but there wasn't much great stuff there for me. It was pretty bang down the middle.
Dell.
I'm going to be a bit harsher, I'm afraid, Bob. I try to be as positive as I can, but I'm sure we'll come on to my gripes with this later on. I think it kind of sums it up pretty much as well as anybody could be. Just, it's a pay-per-view in January and it's got a beach party theme. I mean, that sums up the full night for me.
Yeah. Tampa, it's beach on the posters, beaches on the adverts.
Yeah.
Yeah. All of that, whatever. Anyway, at least WCW do their beach stuff in the summer in the summer. I don't know.
Well, that's
anyway.
That. I mean, they have a bash at the beach when you're not like be bashing into ice cubes.
No. But
fair enough. They tried something different. Best of luck to them.
Yeah, not sure it worked. But anyway, we start the Royal Rumble with a limo arriving into the building, and it's Pamela Anderson. She's greeted by some very keen WWF undercard wrestlers. Yes, this wasn't awkward at all. Anyway, we move on to the WWF Intercontinental title match. Jeff Jarrett with the Brody versus Razor Ramon. The crowd start with a big Razor chant as we get underway. Razor flicks his toothpick at the Brody and then takes control of the match early on, catching Jarrett going for a crossbody, then hits a fallaway slam. Jarrett regroups on the outside. Jarrett gets back into the ring and hits an arm drag before celebrating it and doing his strut. The Brody replicates on the outside. Jarrett then messes up Razor's hair, which riles up the bad guy. Razor then throws Jarrett over the top rope and the crowd go with it. Jarrett invites Razor to engage in a test of strength, which Jarrett loses. Jarrett then hits a trio of drop kicks before flooring Razor with a particularly sloppy clothesline. Razor tries for a backslide, but Jarrett kicks out and then hits a much cleaner clothesline before Razor sits out on a sunset flip. Jarrett hits a neckbreaker before using the ropes for leverage in a pin attempt on three consecutive occasions. Razor slides under Jarrett in the corner to the outside, taking his legs out from underneath him before crotching him on the ring post. The crowd loved that. Razor jumps to the top and takes out Jarrett for a near fall, but Jarrett throws Razor to the outside, then Razor sells a left knee injury, which the Roadie then makes worse by hitting him while the referee's back is turned. Razor is unable to return to the ring, and for now, at least, the match ends by count out. Dell, up until this point, what do you think?
So far, so good for me, Bob. It's, Jarrett's really impressed me this full month of January. I think he's really underrated as just that annoying, irritating heel that just, you can't help but let him get under your skin. The match itself, it was pretty decent. Razor's done a good job with this title. Obviously, it's not going to be any kind of match at WrestleMania 10, this one, but so far, so good for me. I'm enjoying it.
Chris?
Yeah, I'd agree. It's been a really good match up until this point. Both guys look good. Good story being told. Good opener to the pay-per-view so far.
The match appears to be over, but Jarrett wants the title. He says if Razor walks away, he's proving that he's a coward. Jarrett invites people to chant chicken, and Razor finally abates and links back towards the ring as the match restarts. Razor is still favouring his knee, but he goes for a roll-up, and Jarrett kicks out before immediately starting to work on Razor's knee. The working over continues for a few minutes for Razor's able to push Jarrett to the outside. Jarrett returns to the ring and locks in the figure four leg lock. Razor struggles but attempts to roll the move over. The crowd rally with him, but Jarrett is able to settle things back down. Razor begins to fade but slaps Jarrett a few times to break it up. Razor rallies once he's on his feet, getting Jarrett up to the second rope for the back body drop. Razor signals to the crowd that it's over, which gets a big reaction. Razor gets Jarrett up for the Razor's edge, but his knee gives out. Jarrett then rolls him up, picks up the clean victory, and wins the Intercontinental title. Chris, what are your thoughts?
When the match was restarted, I was like, I'm fine with that in itself, but from there on, I do expect that Razor should probably get the win here. It's the classic, like, he was clearly hurt, and then he takes the bait from the heel. It's just a bit stupid for me, really. Like, just save yourself and fight for another day, be a bit smarter. But, I mean, it was still a good match. It didn't take away from it too much. But it was a disappointing ending for me.
Was Chris, did they save Razor in a way by having kind of the almost the excuse that Razor had the knee injury that he couldn't really continue on?
In some ways, yeah. But, I mean, you save him in terms of he doesn't look weak. But in terms of, like, mentality, to take the bait and accept the challenge when clearly your knee's not right, which is the story that's being told, I mean, that sort of undermines him in some way, makes him pretty stupid.
Is that not kind of your classic babyface troupe, you know, kind of the babyface has kind of got the legitimate reason to end the match, but the heel kind of goes him into continuing? Is there nothing to be said for that?
No, I do accept that. You are right, but it's just, it might have been nice to see Razor sort of overcome it. But, I mean, it was still a good match overall, but I was disappointed.
Del?
I'm actually in agreement with Chris in this one, Bob. It was the restart itself. One, it didn't really make a lot of sense, but I just don't like it when the company kind of takes one step forward with making the champion look strong and never backing down for a fight, but then you just go back another two steps when they end up looking stupid for doing it and then losing a belt at it as well. I mean, you can definitely see the logic behind it. As you say, it builds up the baby face to look strong when they're never backing down. They're up for a challenge. They're not going to be goaded into just kind of taking the cheap way out. But it just didn't make a lot of sense to me. And I mean, during the restart as well, Jarrett nailed a figure four on Razor with that knee struggling. Obviously, it makes sense. Work it over. Get him in a strong submission move. And it was just so long. It was kind of like you just disables your ability to suspend disbelief. I mean, it just got a bit too much for me. I mean, they give it a positive, though I did like the actual end. Razor going for the Razor's Edge, his leg buckling from underneath him, and then Jarrett, the cheap heel, just gets a roll up and steals the belt. It did make sense that way as well, and it made Jarrett look pretty good, but you just kind of worry about Razor. I mean, they've tried to protect him to an extent with that injury that he had through the match, but I just think it makes him look a bit daft.
Well, I mean, as someone who's usually quite picky over the small points, and we'll see that later on, I was fine with this match. I thought it was very good. My only real major surprise was that the crowd perhaps weren't quite as into it as perhaps you would have expected, given the characters involved. I mean, I know I referenced a couple of times the crowd popped big, but they weren't all over this entire match. I think when we compare it to the tag match later on, it's not necessarily a crowd that wanted to be quiet.
Yeah, I think the full night, Bob, they were pretty like that. I mean, it was almost as if it was like a Japanese crowd where they kind of sit in silence and then just pop for something big. There wasn't really a lot of atmosphere all night for them.
Yeah, but in terms of the stoppage and the restart, I thought that was very logical. I mean, look, there's a bigger point here about, you know, baby faces getting put in stupid situations and, you know, getting taunted by the heel and then making a stupid decision. But that's something that will always happen in wrestling. That's kind of how you build up heat on a heel and generate sympathy for a babyface. I mean, it wasn't that stupid. It wasn't like, it's not like Razor was competing on a broken leg or something like that. He had a knee injury. We don't know how severe it was. And Razor lost the match, albeit, you know, with the aid of the roadie kind of shoulder charging his knee while the referee's back was turned. But I thought that was all fine. It was a nice way of, one, kind of stopping the match in the middle, two, getting some heat on Jarrett, which the match needed a little bit. And then Razor comes back, and clearly he's not, you know, he's favouring his knee. Then I thought the figure four leg lock spot was fine as well. It's not like this is Ric Flair. It's not like the figure four's a signature kind of Jarrett move. It was more a move to wear him down.
Yeah, I mean, you can see it's not really going to be a match ender. I mean, especially when you've got Razor, you just can't really see him tap him out or say he quits to a figure four for Jeff Jarrett, of all people. But I say, for me, it was just, it just didn't make sense. It was kind of booked into a position where it didn't need to be for me. I can see, as I say, the logic behind it, but overall it just killed the match for me with that restart and the figure four. It just got a bit much.
Chris, did you like the finish?
With the leg given out, I mean, it's just good storytelling at the end of the day. And it gets a good amount of heat on Jarrett, and I guess in some ways it does protect Razor also. So, I mean, it definitely did what it was meant to do.
Oh. Anyway, we move on. We go backstage and Todd Pettengill is in Pamela Anderson's dressing room. Pamela has been showered with gifts from WWF talent, including a Bulldog toy, a Lex Luger t-shirt, and a picture of Shawn Michaels gifted by Shawn himself. Things get a bit awkward between the pair and we cut away. We then get a Jeff Jarrett promo who says it's time to celebrate and he's on his way to see Pamela Anderson. Next up, IRS with Ted DiBiase versus The Undertaker with Paul Bearer. Laura asks where the Druids are. They're not out with the pair. IRS does his usual pre-match tax cheat promo. The Undertaker gong hits to a big pop. Plenty of pre-match stalling in this one. IRS takes advantage of Taker's back turn and hits a drop kick, which barely affects him. McMahon gets his usual shout in that IRS is one of the better technical wrestlers in the WWF, and Laura reckons IRS would have a better chance if his Druids were at ringside. Taker uses RS's tie as a way of flipping him over onto his back before setting up an old school. DiBiase climbs to the apron. Taker confronts him and manages to duck when RS goes to punch him, meaning that RS knocks DiBiase to the outside. DiBiase and RS have a disagreement before DiBiase calls for the Druids to come to ringside, which they do. Undertaker sets for old school again, but this time the Druids climb on the apron and knock Taker off, apparently not a disqualification. IRS clotheslines Undertaker to the outside, who lands on his feet and goes straight for the Druids, causing a distraction that gives IRS the upper hand, who then drills Taker's head into the ring steps. IRS gets an abdominal stretch in by the ropes, using them for leverage, but Taker slides out and hits a body slam before missing an elbow drop. IRS drops two elbows of his own, followed by a leg drop, then misses a splash. The referee is distracted. The Druids put the IRS on top of Undertaker, but Undertaker sits up before IRS knocks the Druid off the apron. Taker goes for a tombstone, but loses IRS fighting off the Druids. Taker then hits a chokeslam before pinning IRS for the victory. After the match, the Druids come into the ring and attack the Undertaker. Taker fights them off, but out comes King Kong Bundy. IRS attacks Paul Bearer from behind and steals the urn. With that, Bundy gets in control. They walk to the back, and Bearer rallies with the crowd to aid Taker to his feet. Dale, what did you think?
So far I'm kind of struggling with the show overall, to be honest, Bob. I think when you kind of listen to these match reviews on the show, you kind of darting through it in 60, 90 seconds. It kind of makes it seem quite exciting when you just take it the big spots. But I mean, TV wise, I think this went about 10, 12 minutes and it really felt longer. Even as Vince pretty much says every time, IRS has a decent technical wrestler. The Undertaker has probably got the best character gimmick in the business, but when you're putting the two of them in the one match together, it's just got a really, really slow pace to it. And I mean, there was good stuff on the outside for the heels with the full urn spot, but the in-ring stuff for me, it was just really slow, really monotonous. I just found it a bit of a labour watching it.
Chris?
Yeah, I agree. The match was a bit slow. It did drag quite a lot, and it just seemed like nothing really noteworthy happened. I do like, just from a side note, the quote, only two things certain in life, death and taxes. So I think having these two lock up in a match is always worth a chuckle in that regard. But I mean, generally the match wasn't too exciting. It was pretty, not much happened really.
In many ways, this was the perfect Undertaker RS match, in just that they're never going to have a decent match, and this was about as good as it was going to get. I think the IRS gimmick is well past its sell-by date. And kind of the whole thing, and I've mentioned this before, you know, if IRS is such a good technical wrestler, why is he a tax man? There's all of that. But no, this match wasn't any good. It was a low point on the show. It never really got going. The stuff on the outside with the Druids and Ted DiBiase wasn't particularly important. I think the only positive I can say for this match is that it did kind of aid the storyline development of Undertaker versus King Kong Bundy. But Dale, I mean, we've been doing this show for 18 months.
Yeah.
And we've had Undertaker against Giant Gonzalez, Then he was in the Survivor Series match. Then he faced Yokozuna. Then he took a break for WrestleMania. Then he faced himself. Then he faced Yokozuna again. Now he's facing RS and he's facing King Kong Bundy next. Are they ever going to put this guy in a ring with someone that is half decent?
It's not looking good, is it? I mean, when you've got a character like that where he's pretty much portraying a semi-mortal man. I mean, he's pretty much a walking dead man as his gimmick lives up to. And I mean, when you've got somebody like that, you're going to get an element of no selling. You're going to get an element of strong power moves, quite a slow pace to matches. It's a more interesting prospect when you get him going up against somebody that's kind of got something different to what he has. And I mean, Bundy in general, I'm not a fan. I just don't like the guy. I don't like the gimmick. He's got no place for me in 1995, but he's here now. He's going to be fighting Taker. I'm just really, really worried about the length that the match gets at Mania. If they keep it short and sweet, you could maybe make it into a good power move for Taker if we can get the win over Bundy. It makes him look quite strong, but it's just for a match prospect, it does absolutely nothing for me.
Yeah, that's the kind of match where I'd literally have heel on top, Taker rallies, Taker knocks Bundy off his feet, hits, well, I was going to say a chokeslam, but I'm not sure that would look convincing given the size.
Believe in with IRS, I mean, me and you do a lot of ECW, Bob, and I mean, if you look at the chokeslam at 911 can throw out there, it looks amazing. But when you get the bigger guys with Taker, it kind of just looks a bit weak when he can't get them up that much. And I mean, IRS, for all his faults, he's certainly more agile than I would imagine Bundy is at this age. So how that would look, I don't know.
We will see. Anyway, we move on. Todd Pettengill is backstage with Diesel, who doesn't want to talk. Todd then sits with Brett, who says that he likes Diesel, but quote, "This is business, this is war." Pettengill asks about the jackknife, but Brett doesn't want to talk about it. We then move on to the WWF Championship match. It's Bret Hart versus Diesel. Diesel greets Lawrence Taylor of the New York Giants, who is invited to watch the show at ringside. The pair begin the match by slanging each other with right hands. Bret goes for a crossbody block, but Diesel catches him and hits a power slam. Bret gets Diesel by the ring post and slams his leg into it before further working the leg back in the ring. Bret locks in the figure four leg lock. Diesel makes it to the ropes. Bret keeps the hold locked in for a few seconds longer. Lawler says, quote, "I've never seen him so aggressive." Bret locks in the figure four once again. Diesel gets to the rope and Bret once again leaves the hold locked in for a few seconds longer than he should. The referee reprimands Bret while Diesel recovers on the outside. Bret then charges across the ring and hits a suicide dive to the outside. Diesel recovers enough to whip Bret into the ring steps. Diesel hits a sidewalk slam for a two count. Diesel begins working Brett's back. Diesel then picks up where in Brett on what looks to be a jackknife, but instead holds him in a submission move on his shoulders. Brett climbs to the top, but Diesel grabs him and lifts him above his shoulders. He can't keep him up there and buckles under the weight. Brett gets a two count before going to the outside. He then drags Diesel's legs around the ring post before using his wrist tape to tie Diesel's legs around the post. Brett works on Diesel, but the referee unties him. Brett hits a bulldog for a two count. Brett drops a fist from the second rope, then goes back to working Diesel's legs. Brett throws Diesel over the top, goes for a plancha, but Diesel catches him and drives him into the apron. Chris, what do you think of the, the heel Bret Hart? I think we'll resolve that as the match goes on, but what do you think of the new, edgier Bret Hart?
It's definitely pretty exciting, and it makes for a better match all round. I mean, I'm a fan of Bret Hart, but this side of him is not something we're really accustomed to, so it's nice to mix it up, really, and the outcome is, at this stage, a really enjoyable match.
Del?
Yeah, totally agree, Bob. Seeing the match prior to the show, you kind of worry about it to an extent with it being a good guy versus a good guy, and I thought the Bret Hart stuff, with him showing that aggressive side that he's done a couple of weeks prior in his TV build-up after he returned, and then in the match itself with Diesel, I mean, we know how good technically Bret is, but Diesel hasn't really got that side to his game, so you've got to kind of change it up and do something a bit different to kind of grab your attention, and I thought the Bret aggression stuff is really, really working well, and as you say, so far, match of the night, easy by a mile.
Diesel poses to the crowd but gets a very mixed response. He then hits a jackknife, goes for a pin, and Shawn Michaels runs out and attacks Diesel. The referee then rules that the match must continue. Brett is able to take advantage after the restart, going back to Diesel's knee. Brett locks in the figure four leg lock again. Brett works Diesel's leg in the corner and holds it in for too long. The ref reprimands him again. Diesel hits a gut-wrench suplex, then works on Brett in the corner. Brett gets Diesel around the ring post, then grabs a chair and smashes it into the ring post. Vince speculates that he missed, but it was difficult to tell. The crowd at this stage, for the first time in the match, start heavily booing Brett. Brett locks in a sharpshooter, but out darts Owen Hart, who attacks Brett before exposing one of the turnbuckles and driving Brett into it. After all of that, the referee decides that it's still not enough for a DQ. Del?
It's not looking good, Bob. I'm very much a stickler for just basic A1 wrestling logic. This, after that point where we last discussed it, it was looking so good, about 6-7 at least out of 10 for the match, and it's just took a nosedive. I mean, we've got wrist tape being used to tie somebody up to the post, we've got the post itself being used, we've then got interference on the good guy, interference on not the bad guy, but Bret Hart playing a bit of an antagonist. I mean, what do we need to do to get a disqualification here? I mean, is it a steel chair
as well?
Well, that's it, the chair's in it as well. There's that much, I'd forgot about it. I think there's an exposed turnbuckle as well. I mean, what do you need to do to get a match thrown out for disqualification? I mean, can they not just announce it as a no disqualification match? I mean, it's just going down a hell fast for me.
Chris?
Yeah, I agree. It is a shame, because up until this point, you have the start of a match that could go on to be a really, really good standout match for both guys. There's good storytelling. We've got this new side to Bret Hart shining through. And as Del said, just a massive nosedive, and it's all downhill from here.
Diesel crawls over to Brett, who barely kicks out. The crowd pop big for that. Brett manages to knock Diesel off his feet, but Diesel gets up and starts hitting Brett with right elbows. Brett gets caught in between the ropes, and Diesel goes to get a chair. Brett returns to the ring and goes down clutching his knee, but he's playing possum and nearly gets the win. Then Brett runs Diesel into the referee, who goes down. Shawn Michaels runs out like a shot. Then Backlund and Owen come following after and attack Brett. Then Jarrett helps Michaels attack Diesel. The referee, after he revives himself, finally calls for the DQ, and the ring is filled with WWF officials. The match ended, and there was called a draw. The ring gets cleared, then Backlund locks Brett in the chicken wing, and the other heels attack Diesel. Diesel then starts laying waste to all concerned before kicking Backlund out of the chicken wing. After the carnage is cleared, we're left with Brett and Diesel in the ring, who shake hands and hug. Chris, your overall thoughts on all of this?
Really disappointing. I really hate this type of booking. Even if you're going to have the two run-ins, the initial one from Michaels, and then Owen coming out as well to break up the sharpshooter, the referee says, okay, well, it's 1-1, and then maybe the match can be salvaged and you actually get some sort of a clean finish. But to then just throw the match out anyway with even more interference after all the countless times it could have been thrown out up until that point is just really disappointing for me. It's just really lazy stuff.
Del?
I'm sorry, Bob, but I'm going to need to take a minute or two to rant here, I'm afraid.
Off you go. I've got my own one in volume two.
Well, that's it. For everybody that's staying on a part two in the WCW stuff, they'll hear you, but they're going to have to listen to me and the WWF here. I mean, there's so many issues that I've got with this match. As I say, halfway through, it's looking to be match of the night. Really chuffed with how it's going. That edgy sidey Bret Hart could easily have been match of the night, because I mean, you've got a couple of spots in here and a couple of ideas that on paper are really good, but they just blew it. You've got a chance for Brett to kind of show that edgy side. We've just seen him have an 8-month title reign where he's a good guy, the perennial good guy, and he's up against all the heels in the roster. Having a heel Bret Hart gives you a full new opportunity to get him to fight everybody that was formerly with him, and you've got a great story to tell on the back of that, saying, look at my last year, look how good I should have been doing, and who backed me up, who was there for me. Everybody that was in that ring at WrestleMania 10 celebrating with me, where were you when I needed you? Now this is Bret Hart, and he's doing it for himself. That's now blue, because after all the work that he'd done in the month coming up on TV, all the work in the match, at the end he just decides to cuddle with the babyface champion, just dismissing everything that he's been doing. The disqualification spots, why not, as I say earlier, one, just announce it as a no DQ match? But no, they can't do that, because that would then screw up their lazy finish to the match, because they needed that to call it out as a draw. The weapons that were involved, the post, the turnbuckle, the chair, the tying Diesel up. I mean, it never got through it as a DQ, but then at the end it did. I mean, it just defies common sense for me. I mean, even just the silly little things like Diesel hitting the jackknife, how much was that built up prior to his last title match in June? Could Brett match the power of the jackknife powerbomb? Brett kicked out of that. I don't know whether that was maybe a bit of an issue because Sean was maybe a bit later. But, I mean, even just blowing that, I mean, that's him just kicked out of the champion's strongest move. And it was just a throwaway spot. There was so much potential in this, and it just ruined it for me. As I say, it was at least a 6 or a 7 prior to all the stuff happening. After that, it was a 1. Sorry, Bob, I had to get that off my chest. 1 out of 10, I thought it was shocking.
Well said. I do disagree with both of you, although, Del, I think you argued your side very well. I think the only thing I can really pick up on from what you said was that your umbrage with the Diesel and Brett hug, I think was quite logical, because Diesel, you know, saved Brett from the chicken wing, and Brett more than anyone will know how painful that thing is after what happened at Survivor Series. So I think that makes sense. And also they built before the match one of a respect between Brett and Diesel, but also an acknowledgement that from both guys that Brett was kind of within reason going to do whatever it took to try and win the match. And so I think they kind of told the story that within reason things are kind of all right. You know, you can push things a bit further. That bit I'm all fine with. The finish I can't excuse, and we're going to come to a minute whether it should have ended cleanly or not. That's a question we can ask separately. I don't mind the whole thing with not calling the DQ earlier in the match. Okay, you should do. I don't dispute that. But I don't mind the idea of the referee going, you know what? It's fine. I would have preferred to have seen somewhere maybe after the first interference by, who was it? Who interferes first? It was Sean, that was right. When Sean runs out and attacks Diesel, maybe, you know, the ref goes to Diesel and said, look, I can end the match here. And Diesel says, no, I want it to continue. And he goes to Brett, and Brett gives Diesel some time, you know, earn a little bit of that respect back.
Well, that's something else as well, Bob. I mean, they've kind of blew that spot in the first match as well. I mean, that would make perfect sense, saying, listen, you're the champion here. You got hit. You should be the winner of this match via disqualification. Do you want to take that? Or do you want to give Brett his chance? That gives Diesel a chance to look like a fighting champion. But again, because they've done it in the first match, again, they've booked themselves into a silly corner for no reason, and they can't follow up, Mick.
No. And then, yeah, the one with the follow-up run out, I didn't mind that. Yeah, the idea of it being 1-1, and you kind of reverse the spot I suggested a minute ago. Referee checks on Brett. Brett, do you want to continue? Well, I gave him one earlier. That's fine. Checks on Diesel. Diesel gives him time. They carry on. All right, it's a bit theatrics and it delays the match in the middle, but it breaks it up quite nicely. That I was all fine with. The match itself was very well executed, and we talked about the booking, but I thought both men performed really well. I really enjoyed Brett's work as a heel, or as a kind of pseudo heel almost. In terms of one, in that he did a very good job getting sympathy on Diesel in a match that easily could have gone otherwise. But we get to the finish and it's like, after all of the, you know, we're not going to call a DQ, and fair enough, I don't mind that. But if you're not going to call a DQ, then don't go, you know what, this is the line. It's like, well, you can't say this is the line after Brett's just hit Diesel in the knee with a steel chair. You know, if the line is beyond that point, a few guys running out isn't, I don't think that big of an issue. But Chris, my final question to finish this bit is, should Diesel have won this match cleanly? This match ended in a draw. That was the official decision at the end of the match. And if you're going to book Diesel as the next Hulk Hogan, I don't think Hulk Hogan's losing his first, drawing his first title match.
Well, absolutely. Well, I mean, even without comparing him to Hogan, who's sort of like a different entity in terms of title reigns and whatnot, but just make your champion look strong heading into WrestleMania. Like, I just have him win the match cleanly. As cleanly as you can after all the interference, but just have him pick up the win. It's not going to hurt Brett that much, really. And Diesel, Diesel needs it, really.
No, I mean, I think there's certainly something to be said for if there's any guy on this roster that could take a clean loss in a match like this and bounce relatively straight back, it's Brett, isn't it, though?
It's exactly. And, I mean, even in the modern world that we're in, Bob, in 1995, WWF has still got a really big audience that's a casual fan. They've maybe just booked the pay-per-views. A wee present to yourself, $20-$30 on a pay-per-view every quarter when it comes round. The last time they seen it, they never knew Diesel was champion. Now he's coming in saying, oh, look at this guy coming out 7 feet tall, looks built, great looking guy, really cool looking. This guy's going to be great. And then you see him at the end of the match and it's just like, oh, he can't be that good. He couldn't even beat Brett. Did he beat Brett to get the belt? What's going on? I mean, I thought this was the new guy. And then you've got him turning up next and it's the new start, as Vince is calling it, to WrestleMania. And he needs help. I mean, nobody's saying that Diesel's perfect, but even in that first promo that he came out after he won the belt off Backlund, it kind of showed a bit of a chink in his armour with that promo side when it's done live. Since that, they've learned, they've gave him some backstage stuff, they've pre-taped it, they've got it in the can so they know what's coming out. They've helped him that way. They need to help him with the booting as well. I mean, this guy's just starting his title reign, and I mean, at the minute, it looks as if it could be done before it even starts, whether he's going to drop it at Mania. They need to help the guy look as strong as he can to give him a chance.
Hyper, 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 it's the wrestling 20 years ago. Hyper, hyper hotline. Call 1-900-123-WWF. That's 1-900-123-WWF. Get Rory video game cheats, Hyper Pro, hits and tips, interview with Bill Nakano, take the WWF Big Fat Hunt. Call now or you'll be indicted by the US federal government. Kid, don't ask your parents permission. Call 1-900-123-WWF.
Calls cost $9.99 per minute. Calls from Briggs Health Phones may cost more. Children's Jacks will ask the parents' permission to indictment depending on both parties' criminal record and dealings with Dr. George O'Hanley and or Jerry Lawler.
We're backstage and Todd Pettengill is still perving over Pamela Anderson. Bizarrely, she still hasn't kicked him out of the dressing room. We get a backstage promo with Bob, Sparkplug, Holly and the 1-2-3 Kid. Jerry Lawler gets on the telestrator, gets a still image of Pamela Anderson and draws over the image of himself kissing her. It was quite funny, actually. I'll give him that. That was quite good. We then move on to the WWF Tag Team title match of the vacant Tag Team Championships. It's Bob Sparkplug, Holly, and the 1-2-3 Kid versus Tatanka and Bam Bam Bigelow with Ted DiBiase. Bob Holly hits a head scissors on Tatanka, followed by dueling drop kicks. The faces go to double team Bam Bam, but he just runs them over with a double clothesline before throwing Kid across the ring. Bam tosses Kid up in the air, but Kid catches him and hits Hurricane Rana. Lovely stuff there. Tatanka gets a tag back into the match and drives Kid into the opposite turnbuckles. The Kid tosses Bam Bam over the top rope, then manages to fall and attack from Tatanka. The baby faces both jump from different turnbuckles, but get caught by the heels. They slide out, bash the heels off each other, then Holly nearly gets a roll up onto Tatanka for the 3 count. Tatanka hits a body slam, then drops an elbow on Holly. The crowd rally. Tatanka hits a slam, then goes for a pin, but the Kid goes to break it up and hits Holly by accident. Bam Bam sets up Holly for Tatanka to attack from the top, but Holly moves, and this time Bam Bam gets hit. Holly goes for a sunset flip, but Bam Bam manages to resist it. Holly is so out of it, he goes to his corner, only to find out he's actually gone to tag Tatanka. He's in the wrong corner. The heels are completely in control. Bam Bam puts his head where the turnbuckle is, and Tatanka drives Holly's head into it in a very unique spot. The pair collide in the middle of the ring, and Holly is finally able to tag in the Kid, who runs wild, hitting a somersault plancher to the outside that Vince, after a delay, calls a moonsault. He didn't know what this move was. Bam Bam picks up the Kid over his shoulders and just dumps him straight to the outside. He then lines up a moonsault on the Kid, but Tatanka gets in the ring, doesn't see him, and bounces off the ropes and knocks him into the ring when setting up for a move himself. Holly rallies the crowd to get behind the fallen Kid, who struggles his way over to Bam Bam and gets the 3 count. The crowd pop big for the new tag team champions. Dale, what do you think of this?
It's pretty simple, Bob. Just put guys in the ring. Obviously, this is the first tag match that we've seen, but get them in the ring, let them wrestle, they'll tell their own story, nice clean ending, no issues. It's just kind of whatever else so far in the show has been missing for me. I really enjoyed that. I mean, they are kind of odd couples, really, the two teams. I mean, you've got Tatanka there as a bad guy now in the corporation with with a $1 million man, but he doesn't really seem to have changed anything about himself apart from that kind of Indian running Hulk up that he used to do. Bob Spark Plug Holly Thurman Plug, whatever he's calling himself nowadays, is a lot better. He seems to be stripping back that gimmick a wee bit, and he works well with the kid. They built that up as that kind of Cinderella story that they were put into the tournament, and then they've ended up winning it. But it was just a good wrestling match, which never had any bells and whistles. It had a lovely spot at the end with Tatanka running the ropes and Bam Bam falling. Made sense. I liked it.
Chris?
Yeah, I pretty much just echo all of that. It was had a nice pace to it. The story was all good. Entertaining spots. And the crowd were pretty into it. Just a big thumbs up. No issues with this one at all.
No, I agree. I don't think this match was quite as good as the opener, but the crowd was certainly more into it. Bam Bam and the Kid are both excellent, doing very different things, but they're both really good at what they do. Holly is a guy who, to me, strikes me as a very solid hand. I don't think they're quite there with the gimmick, but they're moving in the right direction. They're stripping away that name, at least. He's not called Thurman Plug as he was this time 12 months ago. And Tatanka's alright. I mean, I don't think, I mean, they teased something when Tatanka came out in the suit right after he turned heel, and you thought, oh, they're gonna do something with this character, and then they never really did, and it's still the same Tatanka, wrestling largely the same style. He was really the only weak point in this match, but he wasn't all bad. It was largely a paint-by-numbers tag match, really. You know, Holly was the babyface in peril. You know, the one spot where he crawls towards his own corner and then, you know, ends up finds out he's in the wrong spot. That was quite good. Dale, what do you think of the finish?
I really liked it. As I say, I thought it's kind of one of those issues where if you've got Bam Bam in the ring, and it's going to be Kid that's going over him, how do you make it look real? It's, how can you believe? I mean, you've seen it earlier on in the match with that lovely Rana for the Kid, when Bam Bam just launched him up in the air, and then he managed to counter it into that Hurricane Rana and get the big man down. You're kind of struggling when you want to make it look like, I mean, that is his gimmick. He is that underdog, but try to make it believable that he could pin 400, 450, Bam Bam. It's just trying to make that believable, and I thought it really worked out well with that kind of the odd couple factions, as I said earlier on, with the teams. They weren't quite in the same page. The Tonka runs the ropes, Bam Bam falls, Kid just manages to crawl over. I thought it was really good.
Bam Bam exits the ring and starts mouthing off at fans at ringside. His attention is drawn to Lawrence Taylor, who is smiling. Taylor offers out a handshake, but Bam Bam shoves him to the ground. Chris, what do you think of this angle?
I really enjoyed it. I thought it was pretty good interaction between Bam Bam and Lawrence Taylor. I mean, it's probably a testament to the guys involved that there were reports of a lot of people thinking it was a real incident, and the way they cut away pretty immediately afterwards to a promo about last year's Rumble match. I just thought they nailed it, really.
No.
Yeah, I agree with Chris. I think that the believability factor on it was exceptional. I mean, how many times have we seen, I mean, even just going back to like World of Sport days, you would see the old woman at the front swinging her handbag at the bad guy and then they shove them over, and it just, a lot of the time it doesn't look believable. But as Chris says, the fact that they were actually able to draw some fans in with this and make it think, God, what's going on here? And I mean, the next night in Raw, you see him getting called Scott Bigelow, and it did look really convincing. But again, it's kind of the talent outshining the company, where Bam Bam looks amazing and the outside sells it really well. Just kind of, he doesn't care about Big LT, no matter how big a star he is, and even if he's there with his teammates, Bam Bam ain't going to take it from him. But then the next night on Raw with the company, they kind of try and sell this suspension angle, but then they just pop up in the middle with Bam Bam selling the Slim Jims. I mean, Bam Bam's done everything that he can to make it look believable, and again, it's just another example of the talent kind of outshining the company's logic, but actual angle itself, what they've done it brilliantly.
Yeah, I mean, as you guys pointed out, yeah, there were a lot of people who watched this and thought this was legitimate, which is a testament to all involved. But I think there's certainly a tendency when you're trying to do something like this to kind of, you know, go a bit over the top and, you know, be all, like, shocked and have, you know, just stunned reactions and have Vince going apoplectic. And what I thought they did really well was that they really downplayed it. They really, you know, they cut away pretty quickly. They come back and Vince speaks very solemnly about the incident, apologises, but quickly moves on. And they don't reference it for the rest of the show. There's certainly a tendency to take something like this and really blow it up. But even on the Raw that followed, they didn't. It was mentioned enough to the point where, you know, if they'd have mentioned Bigelow at the start and not mentioned him again on Raw, I think that would have been more effective. But obviously, it is an angle, so you've got to do a bit more than that. But equally, I think they showed, I would say, some really good restraint not to overplay this. But credit to both involved. And apparently, Taylor afterwards thought that he was shoved a bit harder than he was expecting. But I thought it looked great. And a very well executed angle. Anyway, we move on to the Royal Rumble match. Pamela Anderson gets introduced, and we start out with Shawn Michaels at number one and the British Bulldog at number two. And what I quite liked was the British Bulldog did not look happy at number two. There's oftentimes, you know, number two comes out, and I can imagine Luger coming out at number two and being, you know, big smiles. You know, oh, look at me, I'm the American hero. Bulldog comes out and he doesn't look pleased because he's in at number two. He's in very early. Shawn starts by going straight after Bulldog in the early going. Bulldog hits a lovely drop kick before pressing Michaels above his shoulders, but not for the last time in this match. Despite being pressed up in the air, someone doesn't try to eliminate Shawn as Bulldog just drops him into the ring again. Out at number three, Eli Blue.
This is Billy Connolly and steroids for me.
Yeah, a little bit. This is one half of the Harris brothers who people remember from ECW last year, and they even lost a squash match in WCW against Hogan and Sting, actually, in late 94. I quite like the Harris brothers. I mean, we're not really going to have enough time to speak about them, but I think we'll get to know them more as the months go on. But in a Rumble match devoid of star power, Dell, I'd have had a better name at number three than Eli Blue, particularly this was his debut.
Well, that's it. I mean, they've started with Shawn and Bulldog, and people's probably thinking at home and in the crowd as well. It's like, well, I thought Shawn had maybe been a good chance of this, or maybe Davey Boy's just back. He looks bigger than ever. He could be winning this with the strength that he's got. So you get those two out first. You've got star power there. How do you follow that up? Do you get a young up and comer coming out, or somebody that the fans know? Nah, they just throw it one of the Blue brothers. So let people get a bit of an opportunity to get excited about this, but I don't know, hopefully it'll pick up.
Well, we'll see. Out at number four is Duke the Dumpster Drewsy. Number five, Gigolo Jimmy Del Rey. Shawn and Del Rey go after Drewsy, but that breaks down and they go after each other. Shawn is draped on the top turnbuckle, but stays in. At number six, it's Head Shrinker Shione. Michaels falls to the apron, but he stays in it, and Shione goes straight after him. Jimmy Del Rey is the first man eliminated by the British Bulldog. Out at number seven is his tag team partner, Dr. Tom Pritchard. Shione presses Shawn above his head and at least tries to eliminate Shawn, but Shawn slithers out. Number eight is Doggy the Clown. Number nine is Quang. And number 10 is a face I haven't seen for a while, in Rick the Model Martel. Chris, we're not doing well on the star power front here.
Not at all. And it's a combination of, for me, the 1 minute interval between entrances, the combination of dud entrance and the lack of time for them to actually make an impression in the ring is a really poor combination. I suppose it's a bit of a catch 22, really, because, I mean, there were some star names and big names coming out, they wouldn't have a great deal of time to make an impression before someone else is following them down the walkway. So I wasn't a fan of 1 minute interval, and we've got to number 10 and it's pretty forgettable at this point.
Yeah, we will come to the 1 minute interval thing at the end. I think it had positives and negatives, so we're about to run into another one very quickly. Quang has Shawn Michaels over the turnbuckle again, but Shawn clings on. Out at number 11, some star power. Finally, it's Owen Hart. As Owen walks down the aisleway, Brett attacks him and leaves him laying. At number 12 is Timothy Well. While Timothy Well is being introduced, Owen climbs to the ring, but is eliminated by the British Bulldog. What a great spot, Del, except we didn't see it.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, we've been waiting for the first two guys went in there to get somebody that, not even that was popular, but was recognised. And we got that with Owen. It kind of feeds into the story earlier on with Owen coming out in Brett's match. Well, Brett's this new aggressive side, his character. He's not going to let Owen away. Wait, he comes out, jumps his brother. It's maybe not the best kind of timing on it. As you say, we're needing that star power in the ring, but prolongs a story. It makes sense. I don't see an issue with it at that time, but I mean, if you're going to have something like that happen, and especially with the early elimination as well, at least for God's sake, get it on camera and I'll let people see it's happened.
Chris, I mean, I think this kind of comes back to what you were saying a minute ago in terms of, you know, this was the 60-second entrance thing, and, you know, we'll come to it at the end, but this was, and, you know, this, we had this last year as well. Randy Savage got eliminated during someone else's entrance, and, you know, Savage was a guy who was probably about as likely to win that one as Owen was this one. But it was really poor, and you've got to be better with that, particularly in a situation like this where you've not got many stars, in that you're going to tell a big story with Bret and Owen, and we'll discuss that bit in a minute because that ties in with something that's sort of going to happen about 15, 20 minutes later. But if you're going to do this story, you've got to make it the central focus of attention. And you know what? Given how close Owen was to that angle, hold back Timothy well for 30 seconds. Not many people are counting. Nobody's going to, you know, nobody in the arena or watching who hasn't got a stopwatch is going to go, well, that was 80 seconds. That's a bit weird. Tell the story you need to tell and then move on. And at least that way you don't run into that problem. Anyway. We get a quick series of eliminations with Timothy Well, Rick Martel and Tom Pritchard all being eliminated. Number 13 is Bushwhacker Luke, and another bundle of eliminations with Doink, Quang, Eli Blue and Sione all eliminated. Bushwhacker Luke eliminated by Sean. Out at number 14 is Jacob Blue. Blue runs, nails Sean with a clothesline before being floored by Bulldog. He then runs at Sean and gets thrown over. It's just down to Sean and Bulldog again. Bulldog picks up Sean and tries to dump him over, but Sean hangs on despite being upside down. At number 15 is King Kong Bundy for some big boos. For one of the first guys that got an actual reaction. Number 16 is Mo from Men on a Mission. He charges across the ring and immediately gets eliminated by Bundy. At number 17 is Mabel from Men on a Mission. Mabel goes straight after Bundy. He points in, the crowd pop. This was something they built to when the... I think it was the Raw before the Rumble where they had the kind of both big guys saying, you know, you're not going to eliminate me. Mabel goes straight after Bundy and goes nose to nose with him. They exchange strikes and Mabel tries to get Bundy over. He can't. Out at number 18 is Bushwhacker Butch. And then Bundy is eliminated by Mabel. Dell, they rushed this spot.
It's, as we've said before, but it's really lacking on star power. And just for you two talking about the 60 seconds thing, I was thanking God for the 60 seconds intervals, because I mean, with the amount of guys that were in here, the casual fan and even guys like us kind of struggle with some of them, and it's, you kind of need them to kind of sharpen up this match, get it going quick. But then the point of doing that is for the times in the match where you have got the star power in, or you've got the story to tell, i.e. Bret and Owen, Mabel and Bundy, Sean and Bulldog at the start, you've got to make the time for that. I mean, Bundy's in here, he's just come back, he's a monster. As you say, on that go-home show before the Rumble itself, the two of them were there, Mabel saying, I'm the biggest, I'm the baddest. Turn round, there's Bundy. I'll knock you out, son. I'm big and I'm bad and I'll throw you over that rope. I mean, it's built up for a perfect angle. I mean, you've even got the potential of the two Men on a Mission guys been in there. Can they team up? That's the point of Royal Rumble matches, to see where the alliances are and getting these stories during the match to see how it's going to plan out. And again, just, well, similar to the Owen one, at least they caught this one in camera, I think, but it's just another story that's just thrown away in a matter of seconds.
And Chris, I actually thought, and you know, we are going to have the thing later in this month in the TV with a two-man Royal Rumble between these two on Raw. But given as, you know, as bad as that bit was on Raw, and you'll hear a bit about that in Colin's TV review, given how bad that was, I actually thought this confrontation was quite good. You know, Mabel gets in the ring, he points straight at Bundy, not there's many people in the ring, and the crowd react. Now, you know, at last they've got something to react to, because it's not like either of these guys are massive stars, but at least they've got some backstory. And I think at this stage in the match, that was all the crowd were clinging to. There was no star power, really. It was just backstory. And this could have been something where, you know, that, you know, they got the beginning right, they got the end right, but the bit in the middle should have been about 15 minutes longer, Chris. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, definitely. I do think, I know both you guys are not big fans of the 1 minute. No, sorry, well, our big fans of the one-minute intervals, but it just holds it back in some places, and it makes it even more frustrating that, as you just said, like, this is something they've built towards before the Rumble, and this is something they're going to follow up again afterwards, and to just have it all done in a matter of seconds, it's just such a waste, and it's the type of thing that could really help this match, because it was not just devoid of star power, but devoid of memorable moments.
Yeah.
I think following on for that point as well, Bob, I mean, similar to what we were talking about earlier on, the story writes itself. Bundy's in there, Mabel comes into the ring, points him out, they have that rumble between the two of them. I mean, it's like Batman and Superman going against each other, who's going to be the biggest and the baddest, who's going to win. It's a perfect opportunity, especially with the lack of stars in the middle of this rumble. Say Bundy throws a jobber at the ring, he then turns round to Mabel, starts laughing, I've just threw somebody out. Then Mabel goes and gets somebody, throw him out, let them compete between themselves for 5-10 minutes, see who can throw the most out, maybe get 3 or 4 each, and then they end up doing the bit with Mabel throwing Bundy out. I mean, it writes itself, it gives people something to notice in the middle when it has taken a bit of a downfall. And it just gives you something to bring the match back up. But again, they just throw it away.
I'm quite scared, though, because you just sold me on quite a good feud to build to a Mabel and Bundy match. And that's a match I absolutely do not want to see. But that, yes, that, your idea there was a million times better than what they did. What they did was all right, but just far too protracted. Anyway, Butch is eliminated by Sean. Mabel and Bulldog try and eliminate Sean together, but they can't do it. Out at number 19, some more star power. It's Lex Luger, who gets a very big pop, actually. And Luger's first act is to eliminate Mabel. Chris, this comes back to what we were talking about before. Well, firstly, about star power, or at least recognition. But Luger is the babyface eliminating Mabel, the babyface. That was the wrong spot with the wrong guy.
Yeah, I'd say so, especially so soon after Mabel's... just eliminated Bundy as well. Let that play out a bit more before you shut Mabel's involvement in the match down. And Luger's just got a big reaction. It's not necessarily Mabel's not really the guy he should be going straight after once he gets into the ring.
Luger presses Sean, but he doesn't try to eliminate him either. Luger and Bulldog have Sean draped over the same corner, but Sean is stuck. Out comes Mantar, who goes after Bulldog, driving him into the corner, then dropping a standing elbow. At number 21, it's Aldo Montoya, the Portuguese Man O' War. Number 22, it's the Hog Farmer, Henry Godwin. 23 and 24 is the Smoking Guns, Billy and Bart. And 25 is Bob Backlund, who comes out to Big Booze. And once again, Bret Hart runs out and this time attacks Backlund. Meanwhile, Sean has Davey Boy's legs caught in the ropes. At number 26 is Stephen Dunn. Then Backlund struggles into the ring. Lex Luger takes advantage and immediately dumps him out. Del, we've had Backlund and Owen, two of the biggest built guys in this match from 1994, and they both barely made it into the match.
Going back to even what I said last month, Bob, I think it's Backlund used to be a great technical wrestler. These days, he is really slow. I mean, even the house shows with Diesel, we think we're pretty much pulled, that we'll talk about later on with the Jarrett insertion there. But Backlund isn't there as a ring entity these days. He's there as a heater. He's there to talk, get good TV gold, get the crowd going. Owen's there as a brilliant technical wrestler. He needs somebody to talk for him sometimes because he's not, his biggest strength is on the microphone. Let him and Backlund get in together. They've clearly got an alliance after Survivor Series, getting the belt, things like that. Let them work together in the Rumble and then maybe do something with Brett then. Maybe let Backlund and Owen get a good few eliminations in. Brett says, nah, stuff this, I'm not looking at this. These two are going out and I'm going to do it. Something like that, I mean, would just make more sense, as you say. I mean, look at the list of names you've just rhymed off there, Bob. Apart from Luger and Backlund, who knows any of these other guys? You've got, when you're in a position with as few stars here, you've got to maximise the opportunities that they're getting, and they're just not doing it at all.
Yeah, I mean, again, the idea of Brett coming out and eliminating Owen and eliminating Backlund is a strong one based on what happened earlier in the show. You set that bit up, and we can argue whether that was right or wrong. We did it earlier on. You set that bit up, this bit makes sense. But I would question the execution. I would have had Owen and Backlund in the match earlier. I would have had them last significantly longer than they did. I would have caught both of their eliminations on camera, which always helps, and I would have had Brett eliminate them both after they'd been in the match for a significant length of time. That's how you wrap up the final kind of 10, 15 minutes of the match. Don't have Brett attack them both and then like eliminate them both straight away. Chris, I mean, that's just such a waste of two of the only a few names in this match.
Yeah, I agree. Between them, they probably, well, definitely didn't make 20 seconds. Like you say, it would have been so much more effective to have them play a big part in the Rumble match itself, carry a good load of it, and then maybe, just so it's clear he's not actually in the match, run in through the crowd and eliminate them both and then continue to beat them down on the outside. There's such a better way to tell the story, and it has the exact same effect. And it doesn't hurt the match, which these two short eliminations did.
Which again makes more logical sense as well, because Brett was in the match earlier on when Owen and Backlund came out. But Owen and Backlund came out after it looked like Brett could win. You want to have them in the Rumble. Brett's not happy about it, but he wants them to be in a position where they look strong and they're going to win. And then at that point, that's why he comes out, that's why he eliminates them, because he doesn't want them winning after it looks as if they could have a chance. That's the way to do it.
Yeah, I mean, it's bizarre. It's, you know, it's not like in the title match they had Owen run out after 3 minutes. They let the match develop because it needed to develop into a good match before they could end it. In the same reason, they should have let these two develop to help the Rumble match and then have... And then you don't have to have the slightly awkward situation of Brett doing the same thing twice. It looked clunky more than anything I would have said for that. Anyway, where are we? Backlund struggles in the ring. He gets eliminated. Hart then attacks Backlund in the arm way after he's been eliminated. Number 27 is Dick Murdoch, who, that was the crowd reaction. They didn't know he was. Number 28, Adam Bomb. Back in the ring. Mantar is on top of Luger. He splashes him in the corner, but cannot get him out. Number 29 is Headshrinker Fatu. Then Luger eliminates Mantar. And out at 30 is the, well, perhaps, pleasant surprise of Crush. Crush runs in and immediately eliminates both Billy and Bart Gunn. Aldo Montoya eliminates Stephen Dunn, and we are left with Adam Bomb, Crush, Bulldog Luger, Aldo Montoya, Dick Murdoch, Henry Godwin, Shawn Michaels, and Fatu. Murdoch has a really good effort in getting Shawn out, but he can't do it. Crush eliminates Adam Bomb. Fatu nails Crush with a super kick. Aldo Montoya is eliminated. Crush then eliminates Fatu. Dick Murdoch does an airplane spin on Henry Godwin. Godwin legs kicks Michaels' feet, but Murdoch and Godwin both go over the top rope. Murdoch goes over the top rope, Godwin doesn't. Michaels stays in the match. We're down to five. Godwin, Luger, Crush, Bulldog, and Michaels. Then Luger eliminates Godwin. Then Luger gets worked over by Crush and Michaels with Bulldog recovering. Luger goes to a 10 punch on Crush, but gets eliminated by Shawn and Crush. Michaels then gestures to Crush to help put him out. It's those two and Bulldog left. Crush does help him out, then turns on Michaels, pressing him over his shoulders, but Michaels slithers out of the way, and then Bulldog eliminates Crush, and we are back where we started, Bulldog and Michaels. Bulldog hits a lovely running knee, then with Michaels lying across the turnbuckle, he kicks him up in the air. Bulldog then crotches Shawn on the top rope. He throws Shawn over, and he thinks he's won. His music hits, and he celebrates on the turnbuckle, but Shawn is slithering and sliding on the, clinging onto the ropes with, well, we don't really see what happens because it's all opposite the hard camera, but he slithers back into the ring. They cut to a wide shot and Shawn dumps out the British Bulldog and Shawn wins the match. They show afterwards a shot showing Shawn doing an excellent job Hollywooding it up the end of the match, and Shawn is your 1995 Royal Rumble winner. Afterwards, Pamela congratulated Shawn, who gyrates near her. Del, what did you think of the ending of this match?
I loved it. It was really good. I mean, I thought it maybe a wee bit funnier if it was Lex again that was stuck in there and it was Shawn that dumps Lex out, just to kind of play up to him getting screwed over in Rumble matches. But I thought that the end was really good. I think it worked a lot better for the TV audience than it maybe did for the crowd, because you can see them cutting away quite quick from Shawn, because it did look, he's obviously holding onto the rope, he's still kind of teetering in the edge. They cut away quite quick to Bulldog, so it looks like he's winning. The touch with playing Bulldog's music was a nice one at the end as well, because it kind of helps get that fact over that Bulldog's won. And then Shawn, the cheeky little heel, comes back in, just shoves the big Bulldog out, takes the glory, and I'm really just chuffed for Shawn. It's nice to see him getting his moment, and hopefully he can make the most of it at WrestleMania.
Chris?
Yeah, I agree, really. It was a really impressive feat of strength, and it was
definitely a highlight of a otherwise very forgettable match. But yeah, it was a really excellent end, and after such a sort of very average for me sort of match, it's nice to have it end in such a positive way. It was really enjoyable.
Yeah, they did a tremendous job with this. I mean, Sean deserves a tremendous amount of credit for really dialing that up, because he could have gone like 50% of the way and still have the same effect, but he really hammed up that kind of clinging on to the top rope with dear life and swinging both legs right by the floor. But he did an excellent job with all of that. And for a thing, you know, where they had some directorial problems and bits with camera missing stuff, they nailed this directorially, which was credit to them. Overall, my thoughts are on this Rumble match, and we'll come to the thing with the entrance time, though we have discussed it a fair bit during the match anyway. I thought the 60-second thing did save this match, in that very little actually happened in this. I mean, we can write that there were three storylines really, I think, developed in this, which was, well, one was the Shawn and Bulldog one within the match. We had the bit with Brett, Owen and Backlund, which were two very brief interludes that they could have certainly made into a much bigger deal. And then there was the bit with Bundy and with Mabel. But other than that, it was a Rumble that was, one, devoid on stories, and two, as we said throughout the thing, very much devoid on star power. And I think on the whole, the 60-second thing was a big positive. Okay, there are times when it is going to make telling stories more difficult, but you've just got to be a bit more clever with that. Maybe go to 90 seconds if you want to. But, you know, if you've got something with the Owen thing, just hold back on the next guy, do that story, and then send him out. Nobody's going to really care if you go 75, 80 seconds on one bit. That's not a problem. That would have been it for me, Del. But I think, Del, they got this about right, I think, given the stars involved.
It's definitely the right guy, and I mean, I think the most frustrating bit about it, I'm in total agreement with you, Bob, in that 60-second thing. I think it would just, I mean, you'd runs of at least 7 and 8 guys at a time where the fans just didn't care. I mean, as we spoke about earlier on, it wasn't a great crowd to start with, but having, what, 4 or 5 names in that 30-man rumble that had any semblance of a chance of winning, I thought they definitely picked the right guy, made up for Sean, and as I say, the most frustrating bit of it for me was just the fact that they could tell that story with Sean and Bulldog that lasted over half an hour from first to last. They'd done that exceptionally well, and then the other couple of things that they had in it, it was just thrown away, and sums it up perfectly when you don't even get one of the big eliminations on camera.
Chris, your overall thoughts on this show and a star and a score rating, sorry.
It wasn't a great show, but it wasn't, well, WWF title match aside, there wasn't much wrong with it. For me, it's pretty average overall. I give it straight down the middle, 5 out of 10.
Del?
There's bits of me that would probably like to agree with Chris, Bob. I would probably rate it about a 5 or a 6 as well, but the stuff just splattered throughout the show for me, just it brings it down. I mean, the overplaying of the first match, the absolute nonsense that went on in the title match, and then the lazy end as well. There was that slow taker IRS match. The rumble was pretty obvious with the little amount of stars that were in it, where it was going to go. But as I say, the 60 seconds did speed it up. There was some positives in it with Sean getting the win, the stories and the rumble with Sean and Bulldog especially. But for the stuff that was bad, I thought it was really, really bad. So I would give it overall a 3.
Well, there we go. I gave this show a 7. We spent a lot of time in the past hour or so kind of picking apart this show. And, you know, partly because that's what we're here to do and all of that. But I think the bigger picture stuff, I think they pretty much got right. I mean, there were, we look at the more micro stuff and you go, okay, I would have done that differently. I would have moved that around. I would have done that slightly differently, all well and fine. But I look at the broader strokes. Firstly, the match quality. You know, the Rumble's a slightly different issue, but the match quality of the 4 matches involved were all very good relative to the ceiling of the match they could have been. You know, Undertaker RS wasn't actually that bad a match relative to what those two could have put on. It's just, it's a bad pairing. I thought Razor and Jarrett was very good. I liked that story much more than you did. I thought Bret Hart's work as a pseudo heel was excellent in getting over Diesel as a new champion. The booking wasn't great, as we discussed, but ultimately, you know, they didn't want to put Diesel over clean, so the draw was the right result once you eliminate that. And we left with the opening match with Jarrett as champion, which I think is a positive. We left the second match, you know, moving on the Taker story with King Kong Bundy. We left this match with Brett, you know, having worked a match that worked, but left very much as a babyface after what happened. And as I explained earlier, I thought the handshake and the hug worked very well. We then get the tag team match, which was really good. Really, really good. The crowd were really into it, and I thought all four did really good, particularly the Kid and Bam Bam Bigelow. We've got the angle with Bam Bam and Lawrence Taylor, which I thought was very well done. And for all of my faults with the Rumble, ultimately, I think if your average fan is watching this, I think by and large they quite enjoyed it, because it could have been way worse. If it had been 2 minute between entrances, that could have been way worse. But I thought they did such a good job of covering over their own self-inflicted cracks, if you like. And they ended up with a great finish. Michaels looked like a star. Bullock looked good. They've got Luger, we're going to talk about after the break, about whether they're going to re-push him. I like Crush. I like the fact Crush is back. And so, yeah, on the whole, I give it 7 out of 10. I think we picked apart a lot of things in the show. But I think when I look at the bigger picture stuff, I think it ticks a lot of boxes. And that's why I give it 7 out of 10.
Vince McMahon opens up Monday Night Raw very explicitly apologising for the actions of Scott Bam Bam Bigelow and for his actions towards Lawrence Taylor at the Royal Rumble. Bigelow has been suspended for 30 days. The show starts with a title change. The Smoking Guns defeat the new tag team champions 1-2-3 Kid and Bob Holly in a very nice 15-minute match. Afterwards, the 1-2-3 Kid asks the Guns to show them the same courtesy they did and grant them a rematch on Raw next week. In perhaps wasn't the smartest piece of continuity, Bam Bam Bigelow is still featured in the Slim Jim advert during the show. HBK Shawn Michaels says he's looking for a new bodyguard. Max Payne is now in the WWF playing a character called Man Mountain Rock. Jeff Jarrett comes onto King's Court and calls out WWF champion Diesel. He tells him that he wants the opportunity to become champion. It's Mabel versus King Kong Bundy in a two-man Royal Rumble next week on Raw, which Shawn Michaels calls the Blubber Boys in action. On the 28th of January Superstars, Jerry Lawler says Bret Hart is prejudiced towards Japanese people during his match with Hakushi. More continuity errors this time on Superstars, which looks like it was taped before the Royal Rumble. Bam Bam Bigelow is still being advertised for live events. We start the 30th of January Raw with two-man rumble between Mabel and King Kong Bundy. This is about as bad as you can imagine, although the crowd were into it more than perhaps they should have been. During the match, IRS and Tatanka come out to aid Bundy, eliminating Mabel. Afterwards, Mo and Lex Luger come out to his side. Bam Bam Bigelow was interviewed by Vince McMahon. Bigelow said he was disrespected by Lawrence Taylor, said he put him on a level below Taylor. Bigelow refuses to apologise. If I shoved him, I should have shoved him harder. Mr. Bob Backlund is on King's Court. He says he won't let go of the chicken wing until the person screams, "I quit, Mr. Bob Backlund." Backlund then attempts to put the chicken wing in on Lawler, who screams, "I quit, Mr. Bob Backlund," and Bob walks off. The main event saw the rerun of the tag title match from last week. The Smoking Guns retained their titles after the match was abandoned when the 1-2-3 Kid sustained a legitimate injury. Thankfully, what looked like a serious injury turned out not to be too bad.
And thank you to Colin for his TV review. We will move into some discussion over, well, a lot of things this month, really. Dale, we'll start with the 1-2-3 Kid and Bob Holly losing the tag titles on Raw. What did you think of these pair of matches?
Yeah, I mean, it was next day, real time, Bob, wasn't it? Like the next Raw, the Monday after the Rumble.
Yeah.
I mean, it kind of makes you wonder where they had that story from. I mean, was it on the fly or was it, I mean, we've seen, obviously, the Kid had kind of blood over his tights at the Rumble, and then there was a kind of pretty scary moment, as you'll come on to talk about, in the match with the Smoking Guns as well. I mean, was that the plan all along? It made sense. I mean, it makes those two look kind of good guys, Kid and Bob Holly. We honour that decision for the week before in Raw with the Smoking Guns. They obviously never get into the tournament because of the injury. And then they said that they would take on the champions after the tournament. I mean, it made sense. There was definitely some good stuff in the matches as well. But I mean, it just kind of made it a bit of a merry-go-round with the belts.
Chris?
Yeah, I think it undermines what happened at the Rumble. I never like short title runs, especially like, yeah, the next night. Like, I'm not a fan of that. It was a good match, don't get me wrong, but I just don't like the belt being, it undermines what happened at the Rumble, and it also undermines the belt. I don't think it helps anyone, really.
And bearing in mind that match at the Rumble as well, Bob, I mean, that's the pinnacle of a tournament that was on kind of 3 or 4 weeks prior to the Rumble and Superstars and things. And I mean, there they've lost the champions at the end of that final tournament match. They've just lost the belts the next day. It kind of defeats the purpose, really.
Yeah, I suppose it does. I mean, I get the sense they were going to give the belts to the Guns anyway. So I suppose it's not like they've had a change of hearts over the Kid and Bob Holly. They threw them together, saw an opportunity, took it, and then moved away. Fine. The first match was good. The second one, it kind of ended too abruptly. I mean, it went on a few minutes, but then, you know, the Kid has his injury and whatnot. But it was a fine angle. I'm a bit disappointed to see that the Kid and Bob Holly, you know, not get their run, but I think that wasn't part of the plan.
Razor Ramon, I told everybody that I was coming to the Tampa Sun Dome, that I was coming to the Royal Rumble to take your title, and I did.
He
but
did.
Not only did I tell you, Razor, and everybody else that I was going to take your title, but I said I was going to humiliate you, and that's exactly what I did. No,
you didn't crawl
out of that ring, much less walk, because you couldn't. But old Double J King, I did more than walk. I strutted in style, flashing lights and all, as the new Intercontinental Champion, baby. Oh,
yeah,
and
thanks,
Razor Ramon,
thanks to that man right there.
You want
the
another
ruddy.
Challenge? Come
you
on, baby. You want a rematch? Come on. Because you're the challenger, and I'm the champion. It truly was a great night.
I agree, it was a great
fantastic.
Night.
Fantastic. I just want to know now, what is next? What's next for the brand new Intercontinental Champion? What can we expect on the Ain't I Great 95 Tour? Well, you know, King, I've had quite a while to think about it. You know, I've been champion quite a while.
Quite a while.
I've had this belt around my waist quite a while.
Less than 24 hours.
And you know, there's still something missing. The Royal Rumble, it was just another stop on the Ain't I Great Tour. But there's a missing ingredient.
What's that? He can't even say it.
King,
what is the missing ingredient?
The one thing that's missing is the World Wrestling Federation Championship belt.
What?
You want the WWF title? But that's Diesel. That's exactly right. Diesel, son, I'm calling you out. You listen up and you listen
real good.
How
greedy can you be?
I'm challenging you here
tonight. Greedy as you want to be.
Chris, what do we think of Jeff Jarrett going after the WWF title, or potentially?
After the back of the Rumble, I mean, I wouldn't say I'm all for it, but I'm definitely open to the idea. I mean, I enjoyed him at the Rumble. He looked good. New IC champion, of course. I'm all for it. It's definitely an exciting prospect to explore later down the road, past Mania.
Del.
Again, January was weird for me, Bob. It's really something that I never thought I'd do the full of last year, was really fall in love with Jeff Jarrett. I just thought he was brilliant this month. He's really just got that annoying stick into a fine art. Title match, it's maybe a wee bit too much, but, I mean, if you look at the competition in WCW, I mean, you get that US title, you're pretty much seen as a number one contender for the world belt. So, I mean, whether this is WWF trying to do something similar to that, can see how it goes. I mean, it's certainly not a bad thing to get Diesel in a ring with somebody that knows how to work and can handle themselves. And I mean, you're never going to exactly get a crowd siding with Jarrett over Diesel or pretty much over anybody. So it could work. We just need to wait and see.
Yeah, no, I mean, some people, like, I've been reading kind of reviews and things, and some people just aren't into the Jarrett thing and all that, but I'm not in love with the character, but I like what they've done with it so far. He's the kind of guy he's got a face you want to slap, which is always a good starting point. He is an annoying heel. I think he's a decent wrestler. He's a good talker. He's got one of the few gimmick acts in the company that I actually think he could ride somewhere. So, like, some of these kind of gimmicks are awful. I don't think this is that bad. And I think he's got something, and I kind of like where they're going with it. And we'll see. So, you know, there's the story of Jarrett replacing, Bob Backlund in the house show title matches. They describe it on TV as Shawn Michaels talking Backlund out of the match, I believe. Whereas in reality it was because the matches with Diesel were so bad they couldn't continue. So they shoehorned Jarrett in there. And maybe it was purely an angle just to tie in the house show stuff with the TV stuff, because, you know, Jarrett's not going to face Diesel, I don't think, before WrestleMania. Maybe that's Diesel's next feud after WrestleMania. I don't think that would be that bad an idea. But that's where that is at the moment.
...standing by to issue an apology to Lawrence Taylor and to his family. So with that in mind, let's take you now, ladies and gentlemen, to Bam Bam Bigelow.
Mr. Bigelow, thank you very much for joining us. Before we hear your apology, let's take you back to the Royal Rumble and talk about the match itself, if we may, for a moment. I mean, there you were, losing to the 1-2-3 kid. That had to be the most embarrassing moment in your whole career, was it not?
You know, you really know how to stick a guy in a ribbon.
No, but I mean, it had to be embarrassing.
It was the kid's greatest day of his life. Every dog has its day. I will give him to that. He beat Bam Bam.
All right, fine. From there, actions in the match required you to go to the hospital later on. You took 14 stitches in your upper lip. You were obviously disoriented after the match was over. Your manager was not there. Your tag team partner was not there. You were left alone. You were left alone, embarrassed in the ring. You got out of the ring. The fans started making fun of you, didn't they?
Well, you know, when you get left alone and all your homies and everybody leaves you behind,
Mr. Bigelow, they were making fun of you, weren't they?
The people were making fun. The people were having a blast.
Exactly.
Everybody in the audience, as far as I can see, they were just having a good old time in my
And you know what? They pay their money, and they're entitled to laugh. They're entitled to jeer. They can do anything they want, and you should not take exception to it, which leads me to Lawrence Taylor. Why did you take exception to Lawrence Taylor when Lawrence was simply doing no more, no less than any other fan around ringside?
Well, you know, it was my opinion that he was just having a little bit more of a better time than everybody else.
No, it's because he's a professional athlete, isn't it? And you felt that he disrespected you. That's what you said before the broadcast.
Yes,
is it not?
Right. Yes, that's right.
In what way do you feel Lawrence Taylor disrespected you?
You know, any athlete that's the caliber of Lawrence Taylor, and that's the caliber of Bam Bam. You put them on the same level. At least I would as a man. I would show pride. I would show admiration to my fellow man, my fellow athlete. But no, Lawrence Taylor had to put me at a level that was below his.
How did he do that?
Well, you know, he smiled. He's laughing, having a good old time. Puts his hand up. Anybody that goes to shake another man's hand, you shake his hand. You don't laugh in his face.
So as a result of that, then, that would be the justification to shove Lawrence Taylor on a concrete floor? Is that the justification?
You know, I came out here last week to make an apology. All out of sincerity of my heart, I was going to make that apology. And it didn't feel right then. And it don't feel right now, McMahon. I'm not making no apologies for what I did to Lawrence Taylor. If I shoved him, I should have shoved him harder.
Wait a minute. You were suspended for 30 days.
Yeah, I was suspended
for
30
days. And I got to remind you that just about everybody in the WWF fraternity agreed with.
Listen, let me tell you something. I don't care about the 30-day suspension. And I don't care what happens from now and then. You listen to me, and you listen good. And you, LT, if you're out there, I want you to open up your ears, too, because I got something to say to you. Now, you want to put dignity and pride on the line? Well, I'm willing to put mine on. Why don't you put yours on? No pads, no helmets, no teammates, Lawrence Taylor. Just me and you. Man on man. That's my apology.
You're challenging Lawrence Taylor?
I'm challenging Lawrence Taylor anytime, any place.
Del, how do you perceive this Bam Bam Bigelow Lawrence Taylor situation?
I thought Bam Bam was amazing. They set it up obviously at the Rumble, and then I actually quite liked the stalling the night after on Raw when they had Bam Bam there standing in the suit. Technical difficulties. We'll be back with Scott Bam Bam Bigelow next week. Thought the stalling was good, and then the next week Bam Bam just knocked it out of the park for me. I mean, there was even some where he kind of dug Vince out of a bit of a hole when he was interviewing him. I mean, Vince was actually kind of getting him over accidentally as a babyface, and Bam Bam was actually coming off as the as the good guy, I thought, in this. But once he got going and saying that, nah, I was thinking about it, I'm not going to apologise, I thought he'd done brilliant, and it was really good heat at the end. Gets out the challenge. Really interested to see how they work this one now.
Chris?
Yeah, I really enjoyed all of the setup. I am slightly dubious about, in terms of how good a match between these two could be. But, I mean, the build-up's been great, that I'm definitely willing to let it play out before I make any draw any conclusions on it.
Yeah, I mean, as we said in the Rumble review, I thought it was a really well played out angle at the time on TV. They haven't followed it up a ton since, and you know, I guess you can only do so much when you're trying to present something as a shoot when it's not. You can't kind of gush over it, but they did enough about it on TV. But you know, if it means Bam Bam Bigelow getting a good match, I presume this is going to be at WrestleMania. I'm all for it, and Bam Bam's great. We know that, and. You know, and whether him and Taylor is a great angle for WrestleMania or a hook, I don't know. But so far, so good. Del, let's look at Lex Luger. All the stuff is a contractual situation. Seems like he's going to be staying. I'm hopeful of a renewed push for Luger based on what they did at the Rumble, based off the crowd reaction.
Yeah.
I'm kind of hopeful we might be able to get somewhere with it.
It's a kind of strange one. I mean, if he's not under contract at the minute, obviously it's something that they need to look at really carefully, Bob. I mean, if they're not going to be giving him that push in this period of time where he's not under a lengthy contract, chances are he is going to walk and he might go down south. But I think it's definitely a sign of good faith, I think, on both sides, that Luger's still there, he's still working with the company, and they seem to be kind of getting a bit of faith back in him as well. I mean, I think what kind of hurt Lex last year is getting that run between a Rumble and a Mania. So after last year, when he had that draw with Brett going into the title match at Mania, it's a very difficult time to try and get somebody over. At that kind of time of the year, you're really looking for somebody that's got themselves over already in the year before and further pushing them up to that main event title match. So, I mean, the timing's maybe not perfect for Lex, but certainly the signs at the minute seem to be pretty promising. I mean, looking at the alternative, if he was maybe to go back down to WCW, the last time he was there, he was a bad guy. I mean, I'm not sure whether he was there as the narcissist at that point, but he was definitely more of a bad guy in the fans' eyes. I think he was hanging about with Harley Race. So, I mean, whether he would go back down there as a bad guy again, would he fancy his chances of getting a Hogan match? I don't really know. I mean, looking at the back of what they've done with the Faces of Fear stuff, I mean, it's certainly somebody that would have a bit more legitimacy. But I think for Lex, if this is the start of another push in the Federation, I think give it a couple of months, give it even a year long contract, see how you get on with it, and hopefully, as I say, we can see him getting pushed up a wee bit again.
Chris?
I'd be slightly more dubious about his chances. I think the way he was booked at the Rumble, like, in terms of, as we said earlier, the Rumble was really devoid of star power, and a lot of the big names, such as Owen Hart or Bob Backlund, they were eliminated quite quickly. So his sort of more prominent role within that match was sort of just through necessity rather than, I think, any indication of long-term ideas about giving him a new push. They needed some, with quick elimination taking place, needed someone like him to sort of step up and fill that void. And I think it just sort of fell to him. I don't know how good his prospects look in the long term, especially with the contract situation. I don't think I get too ahead of myself at this stage.
No, I mean, you are right. He hasn't signed a deal yet. It's just, you know, his contract is technically expired. He's just kind of working month to month, I'd assume now. But yeah, I mean, in terms of the, there's a few different ways of looking at this. In terms of, you know, I don't, have they missed the boat with Luger? Probably. Can they get him back to where he was before? Probably not. But equally, you know, in a roster devoid of stars, they've got a guy who's got something. He's not a main eventer, but they've got a guy who's got something. It would be folly of them not to use that in some way, shape or form, all well and fine. And on the subject of WCW, not that I think there's a massive chance of him going to WCW based on what we've heard, but I think he means more to WWF in terms of keeping him away from WCW than he would to keep him in the WWF. I think, you know, we spoke about a couple of months ago about, you know, this kind of like slow kind of tide of WWF guys going to WCW, and when we spoke about Yokozuna, I said, look, it's not that Yokozuna means a ton to the WWF anymore, but it's not a good look if he goes to WCW, and I kind of feel the same about Luger in terms of, I don't think it's a good idea to have someone like Luger going across to WCW because of what it sets. And I think Luger's got something to offer. Again, he doesn't have to be the main guy. He's not going to be the main guy with Diesel, but it's like, you have other feuds. You have a hierarchy of programs, and he should be near the top of that at the moment until they can come to a time where they can look at their roster and go, look, we've got five guys more popular than Luger, and they don't have that at the moment. When they can do that, then maybe.
He's tremendously gifted.
Gifted, okay.
His athletic ability is so astounding that a lot of the people are comparing him with the Hitman, Bret Hart.
Well, I could see that comparison.
But the ability, McMahon, is where the comparison ends. Because, you see, I know both of these guys as human beings, but they are outside of the ring. And Bret the Hitman Hart is not the human being that Hakushi is.
You want to elaborate on that?
All right, I'm going to tell you. I'm going to hit you right between the eyes with it. Are you ready for this, McMahon?
Yeah.
Bret the Hitman Hart is a highly prejudicial individual.
In what respect?
In respect when it comes to Hakushi and as a matter of fact, all Japanese people. Look at this.
Tremendous maneuver by Hakushi. Wait a minute. You're saying that Bret Hart is prejudicial toward Japanese people?
That's right. I realize Japan bashing is that's in vogue these days. But Bret the Hitman Hart, he's out there leading.
How do you know this?
Well, I'm just going to tell you. I've heard his little remarks in the dressing room and his little jokes he makes about Japanese people. And I've also seen some of the little cartoons that he draws about Japanese people that he thinks are so cute. But I want to tell you something. This is a very serious issue.
Del, I don't know about you, but I wouldn't be in the business of calling my number one babyface a racist on television.
Pretty much. I mean, it's one of these things where we've kind of seen throughout the month with Bret, which we'll probably talk about more on in the Royal Rumble review, but they seem to kind of, it's almost as if they seem to kind of hinder him. I mean, it is just Jerry Lawler being Jerry Lawler, but it does kind of paint that picture with a crowd and a TV audience that you maybe don't want to be doing, considering what a couple of weeks ago he just made his big return to TV. It doesn't even seem to have any legs going anywhere as well. I mean, it's not as if it's partly something that's going to be getting put up as a big angle. It's just one of those kind of comments that I think you maybe get on Raw that's kind of just a bit close to the bone and doesn't really serve any point, to be honest, Bob.
Chris?
Yeah, it strikes me as more of a throwaway remark, but that makes it even more strange in my opinion. If you're going to go down that road and use it as an angle, then like it might not work, but like you're trying it. But as a throwaway comment, it just seems I don't really understand what the point of it was.
I think they're angling for a few with Hakushi. Not admittedly that they developed that at any other point, any TV this month. And given what happened at the Rumble, I don't think that's anything they're angling for any time before WrestleMania, because I think Bret's tied up with Backlund and or Owen. But no, it just strange. I mean, like, fine, you know, if you want to plant the seeds for Bret and Hakushi, you know, a good idea. But don't go on television and even, all right, like Lawler's the heel, all right, fair enough. But don't go on television and have Jerry Lawler say that Bret Hart is prejudicial towards Japanese people. There's no benefit to that. There's nothing that can be gained from that. And if you wanna get a bit cute and you wanna try something like that, why not say Jerry Lawler comes on commentary and says that Hakushi has been backstage and he's been bragging about how Japanese wrestlers are better than, well, North American wrestlers, I guess, given that Hart's Canadian. And if you want to build on from that, then have Bret say, right, well, if Hakushi doesn't believe me, I'm going to beat him myself. That you can set up the same story,
yeah,
Chuck Hardell without calling your biggest babyface a racist?
Pretty much. I mean, the story, as you say, Bob, it tells itself. I mean, Hakush, he's there. I've heard rumblings backstage at Hakush. He's been saying the Japanese style's a lot stronger than the North American. He says, yous are all pansies over here, and he could take any, especially Hitman Hart, that's seen as this great technical wrestler. Hakush, he's been doing that since he was still in his dad's territory. I mean, the story tells itself, and I mean, it just seems a bit of a waste of an angle. And I mean, even how they've got Hakushi appearing as well with the Japanese writing all over him. And I mean, it sounds even just a bit kind of racist, just for the company point of view, just kind of gimmicking this guy up because of his heritage. I mean, it doesn't need to be that overthought. I mean, just get two guys in the ring, let them wrestle and let them make a feud out of it. It doesn't need to be overcomplicated for me.
On January the 21st, an interview was released by the Scripps Howard News Service conducted with Vince McMahon. McMahon described the departure of Randy Savage as personal to him and said it perhaps hurt a little bit more than the Hogan thing. On Hogan's departure, McMahon said, "I don't care how skinny Hogan became or how much hair he lost, he always had that one good match left. He could be 20 steps behind as long as he still maintained that persona, as long as he was in good stead with everyone. He should have left a legacy here that was built that could have lasted. He used to say that Hulkamania will live forever. Well, it could have, but that wasn't what he wanted. He wanted to be in the spotlight. Ego, I believe, got the best of him, and he wanted to be in the spotlight more than ever." McMahon said that Hogan had once said he would never ever compete against him. He thanked America for being a free country so that Hogan could have the choice to compete, but he said that they weren't competing very well. He said, "Ted Turner cannot compete with the WWF, despite his billions of dollars." On Turner, he said, "Ted Turner is throwing away stockholders' money at this, because this is the only business enterprise in which Turner's butt is kicked every single day. He can go buy whatever he wants, the Goodwill Games and whatever to assuage his own personal ego. But the amount of money that he and his stockholders are losing over this wrestling enterprise, this WCW, is astronomical. He just has this personal thing, vendetta, call it what you will, that he wants to drive us out of business, and it's just not going to happen." Vince also said he will never allow talent in future the rights to their characters, saying that it was too tempting for talent to say they could play the character elsewhere. For what it's worth, in the case of both Hogan and Savage, both were using their character names prior to joining the company. Hogan in the AWA and Savage in Tennessee.
Chris, one final thing to touch on before we finish is this Vince McMahon interview. Touched on a number of topics that we've just heard Stuart wrap up. What did you think about his comments about Hulk Hogan? Said that, you know, supposedly Hogan promised him he'd never compete against him, and he has. But I guess the bigger question going through all that is he says that WCW are getting their butt kicked every day. Now, he would say that, but are they?
I wouldn't necessarily agree, but it's not like he has any... There's nothing else he can say, really, in his situation. I wouldn't say no, that definitely not at all, really. I massively disagree with what Vince said, but I appreciate that he had to say it, really. You can't answer that question in any other way.
No?
I think a lot of it just kind of sums up Vince McMahon, the guy. I mean, we've seen this back last year with the full steroid trial and things, where he can almost try to paint himself as the underdog, which always kind of sells a bit more than looking at kind of WCW from a New York point of view, and it's billionaire Ted, and despite his billions of dollars, he can't compete with us. And I mean, it makes sense for Vince to defend his stance, and obviously he doesn't want to say that, yeah, I lost Hulk Hogan, so now I've pretty much lost the battle with WCW. He's got an opportunity here to make the most out of the guys that he's got, so maybe instead of kind of talking about the guys that have left, talk about the guys that stayed. But again, that's maybe not going to make as big a headline as what the stuff is with Hogan.
And that will wrap up this month's Volume 1. This is the last thing we're taping, so Volume 2, I suppose, as well, although you're going to listen to that next. Firstly, a big thank you to Del Muir. Del?
Thanks, Bob.
You're on Twitter?
Yep, Twitter, Del_Muir, and loads of stuff on the Wrestling 20 Years Ago website as well.
and Chris White. Chris, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You're on Twitter?
Yeah, at ChrisWhite14.
There we go, and that will wrap up this show. So, Volume 2, you've got ECW and WCW Review to look forward to as well. You can find us on Twitter at Wrestling20YRS. I'm on Twitter at Bobby Bamber. Facebook.com/Wrestling20YRS, Wrestling20YRS.com. We're on iTunes, RSS. I've just set up SoundCloud as well. I'm going to start dumping just some clips on there rather than full shows and that kind of thing. But anyway, until next time, which for most of you will probably be Part 2, I've been Bob Bamber. This has been Volume 1 of the January 1995 edition of the Wrestling 20 Years Ago podcast. And until next time, goodbye.